and charm. Mikhail was known hardly anywhere as one who preferred to read in his room rather than fritter away the evening on frivolous conversations. As such, the two young men hardly seemed fated for friendship. But fate would not have the reputation it has if it simply did what it seemed it would do. Sure enough, while Mikhail was prone to throw himself into a scrape at the slightest difference of opinion, regardless of the number or size of his opponents, it just so happened that Count Alexander Rostov was prone to leap to the defense of an outnumbered man, regardless of how ill-conceived his cause. Thus, on the fourth day of their first year, the two students found themselves helping each other up off the ground as they wiped the dust from their knees and the blood from their lips. While the splendors that elude us in youth are likely to receive our casual contempt in adolescence and our measured consideration in adulthood, they forever hold us in their thrall. Thus, in the days that followed their meeting, the Count listened with as much amazement to Mikhail's impassioned expression of ideals as Mikhail did to the Count's descriptions of the city's salons. And within the year, they were sharing rented rooms above a cobbler's shop off Sredny Prospect. As the Count would later observe, it was fortuitous that they ended up above a cobbler, for no one in all of Russia could wear out a shoe like Mikhail Mindich. He could easily pace 20 miles in a 20-foot room. He could pace 30 miles in an opera box, and 50 in a confessional. For simply put, pacing was Mishka's natural state. Say the Count secured them invitations to Platonov's for drinks, the Petrovskys for supper, and Princess Petrosian's for a dance. Mishka would invariably decline on the grounds that in the back of a bookshop he had just discovered a volume by someone named Flamen Hescher that demanded to be read from beginning to end without delay. But once alone, having torn through the first 50 pages of Herr Flamen Hescher's little monograph, Mikhail would leap to his feet and start pacing from corner to corner in order to voice his fervid agreement or furious dissent with the author's thesis, his style, or his use of punctuation. Such that, by the time the Count returned at 2 in the morning, though Mishka had not advanced beyond the 50th page, he had worn out more shoe leather than a pilgrim on the road to St. Paul's. So, the storming of hotel suites and the wearing out of carpets was not particularly out of character for his old friend. But as Mishka had recently received a new appointment at their alma mater in St. Petersburg, the Count was surprised to have him appear so suddenly, and in such a state. After embracing, the two men climbed the 5 flights to the attic. Having been told what to expect, Mishka took in his friend's new circumstances without an expression of surprise. But he paused before the 3-legged bureau and tilted his head to give its base a second look.
"The Essays of Montaigne?"
"Yes," affirmed the Count.
"I gather they didn't agree with you."
"On the contrary, I found them to be the perfect height. But tell me, my friend, what brings you to Moscow?"
"Nominally, Sasha, I am here to help plan the inaugural Congress of RAPP, which is to be held in June. But of greater consequence..."
Here Mishka reached into a shoulder satchel and produced a bottle of wine with an image of 2 crossed keys embossed in the glass above the label.
"I hope I am not too late."
The Count took the bottle in hand. He ran his thumb over the surface of the insignia. Then he shook his head with the smile of the deeply moved.
"No, Mishka. As always, you are right on time."
Then he led his old friend through his jackets. As the Count excused himself to rinse a pair of glasses from the ambassador, Mishka surveyed his friend's study with a sympathetic gaze. For the tables, the chairs, the objets d'art, he recognized them all, and well he knew that they had been culled from the halls of idle hour as reminders of Elysian days. It must have been in 1908 that Alexander began inviting him to idle hour for the month of July. Having travelled from St. Petersburg by a series of consecutively smaller trains, they would finally arrive at that little halt in the high grass on the branch line, where they would be met by a Rostov coach and four. With their bags on top, the driver in the carriage, and Alexander at the reins, they would charge across the countryside, waving at every peasant girl until they turned onto the road lined with apple trees that led to the family seat. As they shed their coats in the entry hall, their bags would be whisked to the grand bedrooms of the east wing, where velvet cords could be pulled to summon a cold glass of beer or hot water for a bath. But first, they would proceed to the drawing room, where, at this very table with its red pagoda, the Countess would be hosting some blue-blooded neighbour for tea. Invariably dressed in black, the Countess was one of those dowagers whose natural independence of mind, authority of age, and impatience with the petty made her the ally of all irreverent youth. She would not only abide, but enjoyed when her grandson would interrupt polite conversation to question the standing of the church or the ruling class. And when her guest grew red and responded in a huff, the Countess would give Mishka a conspiratorial wink, as if they stood arm in arm in the battle against the boorish decorum and the outmoded attitudes of the times. Having paid their respects to the Countess, Mishka and Alexander would head out the terrace doors in search of Helena. Sometimes they would find her under the pergola overlooking the gardens, and sometimes under the elm tree at the bend in the river. But wherever they found her, at the sound of their approach, she would look up from her book and offer a welcoming smile, not unlike the one captured in this portrait on the wall. With Helena, Alexander was always his most outlandish, claiming, as he collapsed on the grass, that they had just met Tolstoy on the train, or that he had decided, after careful consideration, to join a monastery and take an eternal vow of silence, immediately, without a moment's delay, or as soon as they'd had lunch.
"Do you really think that silence would suit you?" Helena would ask.
"Like deafness suited Beethoven." Then, after casting a friendly glance at Mishka, Helena would laugh, look back at her brother, and ask,
"What is to become of you, Alexander?"
They all asked that question of the Count. Helena, the Countess, the Grand Duke.
"What is to become of you, Alexander?"
But they asked it in three different ways. For the Grand Duke, the question was, of course, rhetorical. Confronted with a report of a failed semester or an unpaid bill, the Grand Duke would summon his godson to his library, read the letter aloud, drop it on his desk, and ask the question without expectation of a response, knowing full well that the answer was imprisonment, bankruptcy, or both. For his grandmother, who tended to ask the question when the Count had said something particularly scandalous,
"What is to become of you, Alexander?"
was an admission to all in earshot that here was her favourite, so you needn't expect her to rein in his behaviour. But when Helena asked the question, she did so as if the answer were a genuine mystery, as if, despite her brother's erratic studies and carefree ways, the world had yet to catch a glimpse of the man he was bound to become.
"What is to become of you, Alexander?" Helena would ask.
"That is the question," the Count would agree, and then he would lie back in the grass and gaze thoughtfully at the figure eights of the fireflies, as if he too were pondering this essential enigma. Yes, those were Elysian days, thought Mishka. But like Elysium, they belonged in the past. They belonged with waistcoats and corsets, with quadrilles and bezique, with the ownership of souls, the payment of tribute, and the stacking of icons in the corner. They belonged in an age of elaborate artifice and base superstition, when a lucky few dined on cutlets of veal and the majority endured in ignorance. They belong with those, thought Mishka, as he turned his gaze from Helena's portrait to the 19th-century novels that lined the familiar little bookcase. All those adventures and romances spun in the fanciful styles that his old friend so admired. But here, on top of the bookcase in its long, narrow frame, was a genuine artifact. the black-and-white photograph of the men who signed the Treaty of Portsmouth to end the Russo-Japanese War. Mishka picked up the picture and surveyed the visages, sober and assured. Standing in formal configuration, the Japanese and Russian delegates all wore high white collars, moustaches, bow ties, and expressions suggestive of some grand sense of accomplishment, having just concluded with a stroke of a pen the war that their likes had started in the first place. And there, just left of centre, stood the Grand Duke himself, special envoy from the court of the Tsar. It was at idle hour in 1910 that Mishka first witnessed the Rostovs' long-standing tradition of gathering on the 10th anniversary of a family member's death to raise a glass of Chateauneuf de Pape. 2 days after the count and he had arrived for their holiday, the guests began to appear. By 4 in the afternoon, the drive was lined with surreys, britskas, droshkies, and gigs from Moscow and St. Petersburg and all the neighbouring districts. And when the family gathered in the hall at 5, it was the Grand Duke who was given the honour of raising the first glass in memory of the Count's parents, who had died just hours apart. What a formidable figure the Grand Duke had been. Seemingly born in full dress, he rarely sat, never drank, and died on the back of his horse on the 21st of September 1912, 10 years ago to the day. He was a right old soul. Mishka turned to find the Count standing behind him with 2 Bordeaux glasses in hand. "A man of another time," Mishka said, not without reverence, returning the picture to its shelf. Then the bottle was opened, the wine was poured, and the 2 old friends raised their glasses on high.
"What a group we have gathered, Sasha."
Having toasted the Grand Duke and reminisced of days gone by, the old friends shifted their attention to the upcoming Congress of RAPP, which turned out to be the Russian Association of Proletarian Writers.
"It will be an extraordinary assembly, at an extraordinary time. Akhmatova, Bulgakov, Mayakovsky, Mandelstam, the sort of writers who not long ago couldn't have dined at the same table without fear of arrest, will all be there. Yes. Over the years they have championed their differing styles, but in June they will gather to forge Novia Poetsia, a new poetry. One that is universal, Sasha, one that doesn't hesitate and needn't kowtow, one that has the human spirit as its subject and the future as its muse."
Just before uttering his first "one that," Mishka had leapt to his feet and now paced the Count's little study from corner to corner, as if formulating his ideas in the privacy of his own apartment.
"You remember, no doubt, that work by the Dane Thompson?"
The Count did not remember that work by the Dane Thompson, but he would no sooner have interrupted Mikhail on his feet than Vivaldi on his violin.
"As an archaeologist, when Thompson divided the ages of man into stone, bronze, and iron, naturally enough, he did so in accordance with the physical tools that defined each epoch. But what of man's spiritual development? What of his moral development? I tell you, they progressed along the very same lines. In the Stone Age, the ideas in the caveman's head were as blunt as the club in his hand. They were as rough as the flint from which he struck a spark. In the Age of Bronze, when a canny few discovered the science of metallurgy, how long did it take for them to fashion coins, crowns, and swords? That unholy trinity to which the common man was enslaved for the next 1,000 years.
Mishka paused to consider the ceiling.
"Then came the age of iron, and with it the steam engine, the printing press, and the gun. Here was a very different trinity indeed. For while these tools had been developed by the bourgeoisie to further their own interest, it was through the engine, the press, and the pistol that the proletariat began to free itself from labour, ignorance, and tyranny."
Mishka shook his head in appreciation of either history's trajectory or his turns of phrase.
"Well, my friend, I think we can agree that a new age has begun. The age of steel.
We now have the ability to build power stations, skyscrapers, airplanes. Mishka turned to the Count.
You have seen the Shakov radio tower?
The Count had not.
What a thing of beauty, Sasha. A 200-foot structure of spiraling steel, from which we can broadcast the latest news and intelligence. And yes, the sentimental strains of your Tchaikovsky, into the home of every citizen within 100 miles. And with each one of these advances, the Russian morality has been keeping step. In our time, we may witness the end of ignorance, the end of oppression, and the advent of the brotherhood of man.
Mishka stopped and waved a hand in the air.
But what of poetry, you ask? What of the written word? Well, I can assure you that it too is keeping pace. Once fashioned from bronze and iron, it is now being fashioned from steel. No longer an art of quatrains and dactyls and elaborate tropes, our poetry has become an art of action, one that will speed across the continents and transmit music to the stars.
Had the Count overheard such a speech spilling forth from a student in a coffee house, he might have observed, with a glint in his eye, that, apparently, it was no longer enough for a poet to write verse. Now, a poem must spring from a school with its own manifesto, and stake its claim on the moment by means of the first-person plural and the future tense, with rhetorical questions and capital letters, and an army of exclamation points. And above all else, it must be Novia. But as noted, these would have been the Count's thoughts had he overheard someone else speaking. Hearing the speech spill forth from Mishka filled the Count with joy. For it is a fact that a man can be profoundly out of step with his times. A man may have been born in a city famous for its idiosyncratic culture, and yet the very habits, fashions, and ideas that exalt that city in the eyes of the world may make no sense to him at all. As he proceeds through life, he looks about in a state of confusion, understanding neither the inclinations nor the aspirations of his peers. For such a fellow, forget any chance of romance or professional success. Those are the provenance of men in step with their times. Instead, for this fellow, the options will be to bray like a mule, or find what solace he can from overlooked volumes discovered in overlooked bookshops. And when his roommate stumbles home at 2 in the morning, he has little choice but to listen in silent mystification as he is recounted the latest dramas from the city's salons. This had been Mishka's lot for most of his life. But events can unfold in such a manner that overnight the man out of step finds himself in the right place at the right time. The fashions and attitudes that had seemed so alien to him are suddenly swept aside and supplanted by fashions and attitudes in perfect sympathy with his deepest sentiments. Then, like a lone sailor adrift for years on alien seas, he wakes one night to discover familiar constellations overhead. And when this occurs, this extraordinary realignment of the stars, the man so long out of step with his times, experiences a supreme lucidity. Suddenly, all that has passed comes into focus as a necessary course of events, and all that promises to unfold has the clearest rhyme and reason. When the twice-tolling clock struck 12, even Mishka could see the merit in having another glass of wine. And toasts were made not only to the Grand Duke, but to Helena and the Countess, to Russia and Idle Hour, to poetry and pacing, and to every other worthy facet of life that they could think of. Advent. One evening in late December, as he was walking the hallway to the piazza, the Count distinctly felt a gust of frozen air, despite being 50 yards from the nearest exit to the street. It brushed past him with all the freshness and clarity of a starlit winter's night. After pausing and searching about, he realized that the draught was coming from the coat room. which Tanya, the attendant, had left unattended. So, with a look to his left and a look to his right, the Count stepped within. In the preceding minutes, there must have been such a rush of parties arriving for dinner that the winter air had yet to dissipate from the fabric of their coats. Here was the greatcoat of a soldier with a dusting of snow on its shoulders. Here the woolen jacket of a bureaucrat, still damp. And here was a black mink coat with a collar of ermine, or was it sable, that was in all probability worn by the mistress of a commissar. Raising a sleeve to his face, the Count could detect smoke from a fireplace and the hint of an oriental eau de cologne. Setting out from some elegant house on the Boulevard Ring, this young beauty presumably arrived in an automobile as black as her coat. Or perhaps she had opted to walk down Tsarskaya Street, where Pushkin's statue stood pensive but undaunted in the freshly fallen snow. Or, better yet, she had come by sleigh with the hooves of the horses sounding on the cobble streets and the crack of the whip matching the driver's "Hiyah!" That was how the Count and his sister would brave the cold on Christmas Eve, promising their grandmother that they would be no later than midnight. The siblings would set out on their troika into the crisp night air to call on their neighbours. With the Count at the reins and the pelt of a wolf on their laps, they would cut across the lower pasture to the village road, where the Count would call, "Who shall it be first, the Bobrinskys or the Davidoffs?" But whether they ventured to the one, the other, or somewhere else entirely, there would be a feast, a fire, and open arms. There would be bright dresses, and flushed skin, and sentimental uncles making misty-eyed toasts as children spied from the stairs. And music? There would be songs that emptied your glass and called you to your feet. Songs that led you to leap and alight in a manner that belied your age. Songs that made you reel and spin until you lost your bearings, not only between the parlour and the salon, but between heaven and earth. As midnight approached, the Rostov siblings would stumble from their second or third visit in search of their sleigh. Their laughter would echo under the stars, and their steps would weave in wide curves back and forth across the straight tracks that they had made upon their arrival, such that in the morning their hosts would find the giant figure of a G-clef transcribed by their boots in the snow. Back in the troika, they would charge across the countryside, cutting through the village of Petrovskoye, where the Church of the Ascension stood not far from its monastery's walls. Erected in 1814, in honour of Napoleon's defeat, the church's campanile was rivalled only by that of the Ivan the Great Tower in the Kremlin. Its 20 bells had been forged from cannons that the interloper had been forced to abandon during his retreat, such that every peal seemed to sound, "Long live Russia! Long live the Tsar!" But as they came to the bend in the road where the Count would normally give a snap of the reins to speed the horses home, Helena would place a hand on his arm to signal that he should slow the team. For midnight had just arrived, and a mile behind them the bells of Ascension had begun to swing, their chimes cascading over the frozen land in holy canticle. And in the pause between hymns, if one listened with care, above the pant of the horses, above the whistle of the wind, one could hear the bells of St. Michael's 10 miles away, and then the bells of St. Sophia's even farther afield, calling one to another like flocks of geese across a pond at dusk. The bells of Ascension. When the Count had passed through Petrovskoye in 1918 on his hurried return from Paris, he had come upon a gathering of peasants milling in mute consternation before the monastery's walls. The Red Cavalry, it seems, had arrived that morning with a caravan of empty wagons. At the instruction of their young captain, a troop of Cossacks had climbed the campanile and heaved the bells from the steeple one by one. When it came time to heave the great bell, a second troop of Cossacks was sent up the stairs. The old giant was hoisted from its hook, balanced on the rail, and tipped into the air, where it somersaulted once before landing in the dust with a thud. When the abbot rushed from the monastery to confront the captain, demanding in the name of the Lord that they cease this desecration at once, the captain leaned against a post and lit a cigarette.
"One should render unto Caesar what is Caesar's," he said, "and unto God what is God's."
With that, he instructed his men to drag the abbot up the belfry steps and hurl him from the steeple into the arms of his Maker. Presumably, the bells of the Church of the Ascension had been reclaimed by the Bolsheviks for the manufacture of artillery, thus returning them to the realm from whence they came. Though, for all the Count knew, the cannons that had been salvaged from Napoleon's retreat to make the Ascension's bells had been forged by the French from the bells at La Rochelle, which in turn had been forged from British blunderbusses seized in the 30 Years' War. From bells to cannons and back again, from now until the end of time. Such is the fate of iron ore.
"Count Rostov?"
The Count looked up from his reverie to find Tanya standing in the doorway.
"Sable, I should think," said the Count, dropping the sleeve. "Yes, most definitely Sable."
December in the Piazza. From the day the metropole opened its doors, the good people of Moscow had looked to the piazza to set the tone of the season, for by 5 o'clock on the 1st of December, the room had already been festooned in anticipation of the new year. Evergreen garlands with bright red berries hung from the fountain. Strings of lights fell from the balconies. And revelers? From all across Moscow they came, such that by 8 o'clock, when the orchestra struck up its first festive song, every table was spoken for. By 9, the waiters were dragging chairs in from the corridors so that latecomers could hang their arms over the shoulders of friends. And at the centre of every table, whether it was hosted by the high or the humble, was a serving of caviar, for it is the genius of this particular delicacy that it may be enjoyed by the ounce or the pound. As such, it was with a touch of disappointment that the Count entered the piazza on this winter solstice to find the room ungarlanded, the balustrades unstrung, an accordion player on the bandstand, and 2/3 of the tables empty. But then, as every child knows, the drumbeat of the season must sound from within. And there, at her usual table by the fountain, was Nina, with a dark green ribbon tied around the waist of her bright yellow dress.
"Merry Christmas,"
said the Count with a bow when he reached the table. Nina stood and curtsied.
"The joys of the season to you, sir."
When they were seated with their napkins in their laps, Nina explained that as she would be meeting her father for dinner a little later, she had taken the liberty of ordering herself an hors d'oeuvre.
"Quite sensible," said the Count.
At that moment, the bishop appeared, carrying a small tower of ice creams.
"The hors d'oeuvre?"
"Oui,"
Nina replied. Having placed the dish before Nina with a priestly smile, the bishop turned and asked if the Count would like a menu, as if he didn't know it by heart.
"No, thank you, my good man. Just a glass of champagne and a spoon."
Systematic in all matters of importance, Nina ate her ice cream one flavour at a time, moving from the lightest to the darkest in shade. Thus, having already dispatched her French vanilla, she was now moving on to a scoop of lemon, which perfectly matched her dress.
"So," said the Count, "are you looking forward to your visit home?"
"Yes, it would be nice to see everyone," said Nina. "But when we return to Moscow in January, I shall be starting school."
"You don't seem very excited by the prospect."
"I fear it will be dreadfully dull," she admitted, "and positively overrun with children."
The Count nodded gravely to acknowledge the indisputable likelihood of children in the schoolhouse. Then, as he dipped his own spoon into the scoop of strawberry, he noted that he had enjoyed school very much.
"Everybody tells me that. I loved reading the Odyssey and the Aeneid,
and I made some of the finest friends of my life.
Yes, yes, she said with a roll of her eyes. Everybody tells me that too.
Well, sometimes everybody tells you something because it is true.
Sometimes, Nina clarified, everybody tells you something because they are everybody. But why should one listen to everybody? Did everybody write the Odyssey? Did everybody write the Aeneid?
She shook her head, then concluded definitively,
The only difference between everybody and nobody is all the shoes.
Perhaps the Count should have left it at that,
but he hated the idea of his young friend beginning her Moscow school days with such a desolatory view. As she progressed through the dark purple scoop, presumably blackberry, he considered how best to articulate the virtues of a formal education.
While there are certainly some irksome aspects to school, he conceded after a moment, I think you will find to your eventual delight that the experience has broadened your horizons.
Nina looked up.
What do you mean by that?
What do I mean by what?
By broadened your horizons.
The Count's assertion had seemed so axiomatic that he had not prepared an elaboration. So before responding, he signalled the bishop for another glass of champagne. For centuries, champagne has been used to launch marriages and ships. Most assume this is because the drink is so intrinsically celebratory. But in fact, it is used at the onset of these dangerous enterprises because it so capably boosts one's resolve. When the glass was placed on the table, the Count took a swig large enough to tickle his sinuses.
By broadening your horizons, he ventured, what I meant is that education will give you a sense of the world's scope, of its wonders, of its many and varied ways of life. Wouldn't travel achieve that more effectively?
Travel?
We are talking about horizons, aren't we?
That horizontal line at the limit of sight?
Rather than sitting in orderly rows in a schoolhouse, wouldn't one be better served by working her way toward an actual horizon, so that she could see what lay beyond it?
That's what Marco Polo did when he travelled to China, and what Columbus did when he travelled to America, and what Peter the Great did when he travelled through Europe incognito.
Nina paused to take a great mouthful of the chocolate, and when the Count appeared about to reply, she waved her spoon to indicate that she was not yet finished. He waited attentively for her to swallow.
Last night my father took me to Scheherazade.
Ah, the Count replied, grateful for the change of subject. Rimsky-Korsakov at his best.
Perhaps, I wouldn't know. The point is, according to the program, the composition was intended to enchant the listeners with the world of the Arabian Nights.
That realm of Aladdin and the lamp,
said the Count with a smile.
Exactly. And, in fact, everyone in the theatre seemed utterly enchanted.
Well, there you are.
And yet, not one of them has any intention of going to Arabia, even though that is where the lamp is.
By some extraordinary conspiracy of fate, at the very instant Nina made this pronouncement, the accordion player concluded an old favourite, and the sparsely populated room broke into applause. Sitting back, Nina gestured to her fellow customers with both hands as if their ovation were the final proof of her position. It is the mark of a fine chess player to tip over his own king when he sees that defeat is inevitable, no matter how many moves remain in the game. Thus, the Count inquired,
How was your hors d'oeuvre?
Splendid!
The accordion player now began to play a jaunty little melody reminiscent of an English carol. Taking this as his signal, the Count indicated that he would like to make a toast.
It is a sad but unavoidable fact of life, he began, that as we age our social circles grow smaller, whether from increased habit or diminished figure, we suddenly find ourselves in the company of just a few familiar faces. So I view it as an incredible stroke of good fortune at this stage in my life
to have found such a fine new friend. With that, the Count reached into his pocket and presented Nina with a gift. Here is a little something that I made great use of when I was your age. May it tide you over until you travel incognito. Nina smiled in a manner that suggested, rather unconvincingly, that he absolutely shouldn't have. Then she unwrapped the paper to reveal the Countess Rostov's hexagonal opera glasses. They were my grandmother's, said the Count. For the first time in their acquaintance, Nina was struck dumb. She turned the little binoculars in her hands, admiring the mother-of-pearl scopes and delicate brass fittings. Then she held them to her eyes, so she could slowly scan the room. You know me better than anyone, she said after a moment. I shall treasure them to my dying day. That she had not thought to bring a present for the Count struck him as perfectly understandable. After all, she was only a child, and the days of unwrapping surprises were decidedly behind him. It's getting late, said the Count. I wouldn't want you to keep your father waiting. Yes, she admitted regretfully. It is time for me to go. Then looking back toward the captain's station, she raised a hand as one who signals for the check. But when the captain approached the table, he did not have the check. Instead, he had a large yellow box tied with dark green ribbon. Here, Nina said, is a little something for you. But you must promise that you will not open it until the stroke of midnight. When Nina left the piazza to join her father, the Count's intention had been to settle the check, proceed to the Boyarsky for an herb-encrusted lamb chop, and then retire to his study with a glass of port to await the chime of 12. But as the accordion player launched into a second carol, the Count found himself turning his attention to the neighbouring table, where a young man seemed to be in the earliest stages of romantic discovery. In some lecture hall, this lad with a hint of a moustache had presumably admired his fellow student for the sharpness of her intellect and the seriousness of her mien. Eventually, he had worked up the nerve to invite her out, perhaps under the pretense of discussing some matter of ideological interest. And now, here she was, sitting before him in the piazza, looking about the room without a smile on her face or a word on her lips. Attempting to break the silence, the lad remarked on the upcoming conference to unify the Soviet republics, a reasonable gambit, given her apparent intensity. Sure enough, the young lady had views on the subject, but as she voiced her opinion on the Transcaucasus question, the tenor of the conversation turned decidedly technical. What's more, the young man, having adopted an expression as serious as hers, was clearly out of his depth. Were he to venture his own opinion now, he would almost certainly be revealed as a poser, as one who was inadequately informed on the crucial issues of the day. From there, the evening could only get worse, and he would end up dragging his hopes behind him in the manner of the chastened child who drags his stuffed bear thumping up the stairs. But just as the young lady was inviting him to share his thoughts on the matter, the accordion player began a little number with a Spanish flair. It must have struck a chord, because she interrupted herself in order to look at the musician and wonder aloud where that melody was from. "It is from the Nutcracker," the young man responded without a thought. "The Nutcracker," she repeated. Given the prevailing sobriety of her expression, it was unclear what she thought of this music from another era. As such, many a veteran would have counseled the young man to proceed with caution, to wait and hear what associations the music held for her. Instead, he acted, and he acted boldly. "When I was a boy, my grandmother took me every year." The young lady turned back from the musician to face her companion. "I suppose some think the music sentimental," he continued, "but I never fail to attend the ballet when it is performed in December, even if it means attending alone."
Well done, lad. The expression on the girl's face softened noticeably, and her eyes displayed a hint of interest that here was an unexpected aspect of her new acquaintance, something pure and heartfelt and unapologetic. Her lips parted as she prepared to ask a question.
Are you ready to order?
It was the bishop, leaning over their table.
Of course they are not ready to order, the count wished to shout, as any fool can see.
If the young man were wise, he would send the bishop packing and ask the young lady to go on with her question. Instead, he dutifully picked up the menu. Perhaps he imagined that the perfect dish would leap off the page and identify itself by name. But for a hopeful young man trying to impress a serious young woman, the menu of the piazza was as perilous as the Straits of Messina. On the left was a scilla of lower-priced dishes that could suggest a penny-pinching lack of flair. And on the right was a charybdis of delicacies that could empty one's pockets while painting one pretentious. The young man's gaze drifted back and forth between these opposing hazards. But in a stroke of genius, he ordered the Latvian stew. While this traditional dish of pork, onions, and apricots was reasonably priced, it was also reasonably exotic, and it somehow harkened back to that world of grandmothers and holidays and sentimental melodies that they had been about to discuss when so rudely interrupted.
I'll have the same, said our serious young lady.
The same.
And then she glanced at her hopeful young acquaintance with a touch of that tenderness that Natasha had shown Pierre in War and Peace at the end of Volume 2.
And would you like some wine to go with your stew?
Asked the bishop. The young man hesitated and then picked up the wine list with uncertain hands. It may well have been the first time in his life that he had ordered a bottle of wine. Never mind that he didn't grasp the merits of the 1900 versus the 1901. He didn't know a Burgundy from a Bordeaux. Giving the young man no more than a minute to consider his options, the bishop leaned forward and poked the list with a condescending smile.
Perhaps the Rioja.
The Rioja?
Now there was a wine that would clash with the stew as Achilles clashed with Hector. It would slay the dish with a blow to the head and drag it behind its chariot until it tested the fortitude of every man in Troy. Besides, it plainly cost 3 times what the young man could afford. With a shake of the head, the count reflected that there was simply no substitute for experience. Here had been an ideal opportunity for a waiter to fulfill his purpose. By recommending a suitable wine, he could have put a young man at ease, perfected a meal, and furthered the cause of romance, all in a stroke. But whether from a lack of subtlety or a lack of sense, the bishop had not only failed in his purpose, he had put his customer in a corner. And the young man, clearly unsure of what to do and beginning to feel as if the whole restaurant were watching, was on the verge of accepting the bishop's suggestion.
If I may, the count interjected, for a serving of Latvian stew, you will find no better choice than a bottle of the Mukazani.
Leaning toward their table and mimicking the perfectly parted fingers of Andre, the count gestured to the entry on the list. That this wine was a fraction of the cost of the Rioja need not be a matter of a discussion between gentlemen. Instead, the count simply noted, the Georgians practically grow their grapes in the hopes that one day they will accompany such a stew. The young man exchanged a brief glance with his companion, as if to say, who is this eccentric? But then he turned to the bishop.
A bottle of the Mukazani.
Of course, replied the bishop.
Minutes later, the wine had been presented and poured, and the young woman was asking her companion what his grandmother was like. While for his part, the count cast off any thoughts of herb-encrusted lamb at the Boyarsky. Instead, he summoned Petya to take Nina's present to his room and ordered the Latvian stew and a bottle of the Mukazani for himself. And just as he'd expected, It was the perfect dish for the season. The onions thoroughly caramelized, the pork slowly braised, and the apricots briefly stewed, the three ingredients came together in a sweet and smoky medley that simultaneously suggested the comfort of a snowed-in tavern and the jangle of a gypsy tambourine. As the Count took a sip of his wine, the young couple caught his eye and raised their own glasses in a toast of gratitude and kinship. Then they returned to their conversation, which had grown so intimate it could no longer be heard over the sound of the accordion. "Young love," thought the Count with a smile, "there is nothing novier about it. Will there be anything else?" It was the bishop addressing the Count. He considered for a moment. Then he asked for a single scoop of vanilla ice cream. As the Count entered the lobby, he noticed four men in evening dress coming through the door with black leather cases in hand, clearly one of the string quartets that occasionally played in the private dining rooms upstairs. Three of the musicians looked as if they had been performing together since the 19th century, sharing the same white hair and weary professionalism. But the second violinist stood out from the others, as he couldn't have been more than 22, and retained a certain brightness to his step. It was only as the quartet approached the elevator that the Count recognized him. The Count probably hadn't seen Nikolai Petrov since 1914, when the prince had been no more than a lad of 13. And given the passage of time, the Count might not have recognized him at all, were it not for his unassuming smile, a distinguishing feature of the Petrov line for generations. "Nikolai?" When the Count spoke, the four musicians turned from the elevator and eyed him with curiosity. "Alexander Ilyich?" the prince asked after a moment. "None other." The prince encouraged his colleagues to go ahead and then offered the Count the familial smile. "It's good to see you, Alexander."
"And you?"
They were quiet for a moment. Then the prince's expression changed from one of surprise to curiosity.
"Is that ice cream?"
"What?
Oh, yes, it is. Though not for me."
The prince nodded in bemusement, but without further remark.
"Tell me," the Count ventured, "have you heard from Dmitri?"
"I believe he is in Switzerland."
"Ah," said the Count with a smile, "the purest air in Europe."
The prince shrugged, as if to say he had heard something of the sort, but wouldn't know firsthand.
"The last time I saw you," observed the Count, "you were playing Bach at one of your grandmother's dinner parties."
The prince laughed and held up his case. "I guess I am still playing Bach at dinner parties." Then he gestured toward the departed elevator and said with unmistakable fondness, "That was Sergei Eisenhoff."
"No."
At the turn of the century, Sergei Eisenhoff had given music lessons to half the boys on the Boulevard Ring.
"It's not easy for our likes to find work," said the prince, "but Sergei hires me when he can."
The Count had so many questions. Were there other members of the Petrov family still in Moscow? Was his grandmother alive? Was he still living in that wonderful house on Pushkin Square? But the two were standing in the middle of a hotel lobby as men and women headed up the stairs, including some in formal clothes.
"They'll be wondering what's become of me," said the prince.
"Yes, of course. I didn't mean to keep you."
The prince nodded and turned to mount the stairs, but then turned back.
"We are playing here again on Saturday night," he said. "Perhaps we could meet afterwards for a drink."
"That would be splendid," said the Count.
Among readers of European fiction, the character names in Russian novels are notorious for their difficulty. Not content to rely on given and family names, we Russians like to make use of honorifics, patronymics, and an array of diminutives, such that a single character in one of our novels may be referred to in four different ways in as many pages. To make matters worse, it seems that our greatest authors, due to some deep-rooted sense of tradition or a complete lack of imagination, constrain themselves to the use of 30 given names.
You cannot pick up a work of Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, or Turgenev without bumping into an Anna, an Andre, or an Alexander. Thus it must be with some trepidation that our Western reader meets any new character in a Russian novel, knowing that in the remote chance this character plays an important role in future chapters, he must now stop and commit the name to memory. As such, I think it only fair to inform you now that while Prince Nikolai Petrov has agreed to meet the Count on Saturday night for a drink, he will not be keeping the appointment. For when the quartet finishes their engagement at midnight, young Prince Nikolai will button his overcoat, tighten his scarf, and walk to his family's residence on Pushkin Square. Needless to say, when he arrives at 12:30, there are no footmen to greet him. With his violin in hand, he mounts the staircase headed toward the room on the fourth floor that has been left to his use. Though the house seems empty, on the second floor, Nikolai comes upon two of the house's newer residents smoking cigarettes. Nikolai recognizes one of them as the middle-aged woman who now lives in the nursery. The other is the bus operator with a family of four who lives in his mother's boudoir. When the prince wishes them a good night with the unassuming smile of the house, neither says a word. But when he reaches the fourth floor, he understands their reticence and can hardly blame them. For standing in the hallway are three men from Cheka waiting to search his room. Upon seeing them, Prince Nikolai does not make a scene or voice some idle protest. After all, it is the third time they have searched his room in 6 months, and he even recognizes one of the fellows. So, familiar with the procedure and weary from a long day, he offers them the same unassuming smile, lets them inside, and sits at the little table by the window as they go about their business. The prince has nothing to hide. Just 16 years old when the Hermitage fell, he has never read a tract or harbored a grudge. If you asked him to play the imperial anthem, he wouldn't remember how. He even sees some sense in his grand old house being divvied up. His mother and sisters in Paris, his grandparents dead, the family servants scattered to the winds. What was he going to do with 30 rooms? All he really needed was a bed, a wash basin, and a chance to work. But at 2 in the morning, the prince is awakened with a shove by the officer in charge. In his hands is a textbook, a Latin grammar from Nikolai's days at the Imperial Lyceum.
Is it yours?
There is no point in lying.
Yes, he says. I attended the academy when I was a boy.
The officer opens the book, and there on the front plate, looking regal and wise, is a picture of Tsar Nicholas II, the possession of which is a crime. The prince has to laugh, for he had taken such pains to remove all portraits, crests, and royal insignia from his room. The captain slices the page out of the grammar with the blade of a knife. He marks the back with the time and place, and has the prince undersign it. The prince is taken to the Lubyanka, where he is held for several days and questioned once again regarding his loyalties. On the fifth day, all things considered, fate spares him, for he is not ushered to the courtyard and put against the wall, nor is he shipped off to Siberia. He is merely given a -6, the administrative sentence that allows him to roam Russia at will, as long as he never sets foot in Moscow, St. Petersburg, Kiev, Kharkov, Yekaterinburg, and Tbilisi, that is, the country's 6 largest cities. About 50 miles from Moscow in Tukovo, the young prince resumes his life, and for the most part he does so without resentment, indignation, or nostalgia. In his new hometown, the grass still grows, the fruit trees blossom, and young women come of age. In addition, by virtue of his remoteness, he is spared the knowledge that 1 year after his sentence, a trio of Cheka will be waiting for his old instructor when he comes home to the small apartment where he lives with his aging wife. When they haul him before a troika,
What seals his fate and sends him to the camps is evidence that on multiple occasions he had hired former person Nikolai Petrov to play in his quartet, despite a clear prohibition against doing so. But having said that you needn't bother to remember the name of Prince Petrov, I should note that despite the brief appearance of the round-faced fellow with a receding hairline a chapter hence, he is someone you should commit to memory. For years later, he will have great bearing on the outcome of this tale. When the Count arrived on the sixth floor, he clicked his tongue three times, then went into his bedroom, leaving the door ajar. On the desk sat Nina's gift where Petya had left it. Taking it under an arm, the Count passed through his jackets into his study, set the present on his grandmother's table, and put the bowl of melted ice cream on the floor. As the Count poured himself a glass of port, a silvery shadow swerved around his feet and approached the bowl.
"Happy holidays to you, Herr Drosselmeier."
"Meow,"
replied the cat. According to the twice-tolling clock, it was only 11. So with his port in one hand and a Christmas carol in the other, the Count tilted back his chair and dutifully waited for the chime of 12. Admittedly, it takes a certain amount of discipline to sit in a chair and read a novel, even a seasonal one, when a beautifully wrapped present waits within arm's reach, and the only witness is a one-eyed cat. But this was a discipline the Count had mastered as a child, when, in the days leading up to Christmas, he had marched past the closed drawing-room doors with the unflinching stare of a Buckingham Palace guard. The young Count's self-mastery did not stem from a precocious admiration of military regimentation, nor a priggish adherence to household rules. By the time he was 10, it was perfectly clear that the Count was neither priggish nor regimental, as a phalanx of educators, caretakers, and constables could attest. No, if the Count mastered the discipline of marching past the closed drawing-room doors, it was because experience had taught him that this was the best means of ensuring the splendour of the season. For on Christmas Eve, when his father finally gave the signal and he and Helena were allowed to pull the doors apart, there was the 12-foot spruce lit up from trunk to tip and garlands hanging from every shelf. There were the bowls of oranges from Seville and the brightly coloured candies from Vienna. And hidden somewhere under the tree was that unexpected gift, be it a wooden sword with which to defend the ramparts, or a lantern with which to explore a mummy's tomb. Such is the magic of Christmas in childhood, thought the Count, a little wistfully, that a single gift can provide one with endless hours of adventure, while not even requiring one to leave one's house. Drosselmeier, who had retired to the other high-backed chair to lick his paws, suddenly turned his one-eyed gaze toward the closet door with his little ears upright. What he must have heard was the whirring of inner wheels, for a second later came the first of midnight's chimes. Setting his book and his port aside, the Count placed Nina's gift in his lap with his fingers on the dark green bow and listened to the tolling of the clock. Only with the 12th and final chime did he pull the ribbon's ends. "What do you think, mein Herr? A dapper hat?" The cat looked up at the Count and, in deference to the season, began to purr. The Count replied with a nod and then carefully lifted the lid, only to discover another box wrapped in yellow and tied with a dark green bow. Setting the empty box aside, the Count nodded again to the cat, pulled the strands of the second bow, and lifted the second lid, only to discover a third box. Dutifully, the Count repeated the debowing and unlidding with the next three boxes, until he held one the size of a matchbox. But when he untied the bow and lifted the lid on this box, inside the cozy chamber, strung on a bit of the dark green ribbon, was Nina's passkey to the hotel. When the Count climbed into bed with his Dickens at 12:15, He assumed he would only read a paragraph or two before switching off the light, but instead he found himself reading with the greatest interest.